Clarion Call, Part 3. IPOVOQ. Blue Sector. Corwin woke to find the lights of his stateroom automatically dimmed. He knew from experience that, on Babylon 6, this meant it was sometime between 2100 and 0500 hours, and that meant, like as not, that he had blown it. He turned over, looked at the time display in the instrument cluster on the bulkhead next to the bunk, and sighed. Yep. 21:15, 9:15 p.m., Avalon Standard Time. Shit, he grumbled, sitting up. It was, he knew, no good trying to go back to sleep now. If he was lucky, he'd be able to grab a nap on the other end, an hour or two before his attendants came to roust him. But in the meantime, the long night shift stretched empty before him. He wasn't worried about being tired for the ceremony tomorrow. He had reserves to draw on, ways of ensuring that he'd be wide awake. He didn't need, though he would gladly take, weather permitting, as much sleep as a normal man anyway. There was just the question of what to do for the next 11 hours, especially since he wasn't technically supposed to leave the VOQ. Well, he thought, I've got the run of this res block, I can at least go for a walk. Indeed, if he played his cards right, maybe he'd even be able to slip down to the Wonder and get his book, which, like an idiot, he could see it in his mind's eye. He'd left sitting on the table in the wardroom. There was still a uniformed security officer on duty by the lift, though it was a different guy. Corwin wondered idly whether he'd try to stop him from leaving the floor, but in fact he just looked up from whatever he was doing on his portable terminal, nodded, and went back to it. Corwin was able to get over to the hangar deck and aboard the Wonder unchallenged. He supposed wryly that his mother and the others probably didn't feel it would be necessary to post anyone to keep him from leaving. He found his book right where he expected it to be, collected it, and made ready to leave. As he locked up the Wonder again, he pondered that perverse impulse that always nags a man to do whatever he's least supposed to be doing. On an ordinary Thursday evening, without an explicit ban on stopping by Green Sector, he might well spend the night alone in the VOQ, or aboard the Wonder, or wherever, and not think twice about it. But because he was specifically not supposed to go to Green and see anyone there tonight, he found himself unable to muster much enthusiasm for doing anything else. Sighing, Corwin headed back upstairs, resigning himself to an evening of distractedly reading the same page over and over again without comprehending what was on it. He waved glumly to the security guy when he arrived back on the VOQ block, and had almost reached his quarters when the door of the second room from the end opened, and a sleek white, pod-like figure nearly collided with him. "Whoa," he said, half dancing back as the white shape skidded to an aerial halt and backed up a little. He knew what it—she, his instincts at once corrected him— was immediately, having followed the development of the EVE series from afar with a professional's interest, but he'd never actually seen one before. As far as he knew, only one existed, though the last he'd been aware the prototype was still on test assignment. He didn't know more than the basic spec sheet stuff about the series, since he hadn't been involved in the actual development process. But watching the floating robot's body language as she backed up, looked him over, and then glanced up the hall at the security man, he got the distinct impression that she was anxious about something. She was about to turn and make for the lift when Corwin asked, "What's the matter? Maybe I can help." Eve looked at him again, hesitating. Then a blue-white light shone from beneath her smooth white casing, on her right side just below the rim of her repulsor field neck, and scanned him up and down. As it did so, a row of three white lights below the scan source, on what Corwin supposed you'd call her chest, lit up one by one, followed by a larger green one that was accompanied by a musical tone. Eve's light matrix eyes blinked, then widened, as her internal subether link to the IPO's master database returned a positive identification based on her scan. Ravenhair, Corwin V. Born June 25th, 2391, Nekomikoka Tomodachi. Son of Ravenhair, Skuld, IPO Prime Technologist, and Hutchins, Benjamin Griffin, IPO Chief. Roboticist, Weapons Engineer, Spacecraft Designer. Creator of Record, Armored Knight G-Kaiser, Getter Robo Series, Gaigar System. Sponsored Personal Robot, R. Dorothy Wainwright, XREF, for Turing certification 2405. Suitability, high. Confidence, high. Eve immediately aborted her original plan, which was to get to the lift shaft and try to summon help from the station's robot repair facilities down in Red Sector. Instead, she grabbed Corwin's sleeve. Like his father, he was struck by how cunningly articulated her hands were, and tugged him into the room from which she'd just emerged. Gesturing to another, much less sleek, robotic figure in the middle of the room, Eve turned pleading eyes to Corwin and said, "Help." Corwin blinked, put his book down on the table by the door, then went and crouched by the other robot. This was a much earlier model, a small and blocky utility droid, and it had obviously seen a lot of wear and tear. It took Corwin a moment to realize that he was at least passingly familiar with the model, a U.S. Robotics Wall-E unit. He'd seen one in the Tomodachi Colonization Museum. "Hello," said Corwin. The industrial robot turned its binocular-like head toward him, its optics focusing, and then slowly, shakily raised one fork-like hand. "Wall-E," it croaked. Corwin looked momentarily taken aback, then realized that the robot wanted to shake hands. In even that small gesture, his practiced eye could see that this, too, was no mere it. He smiled, shook the offered hand, and said, "Hi, I'm Corwin. Looks like you're having some motor problems." Wally nodded. His head was about the only part of him he could move without difficulty, it seemed. He seemed alert, and he didn't look particularly alarmed, just a bit puzzled. "Can you fill me in, Eve?" Corwin asked his impromptu patience hovering companion. "Wally's having a hard time getting his signaler working." Then, switching to a weird, high-pitched trilling language, he added, "Go ahead and code stream it if you want." Eve was markedly taken aback by this development. She'd never encountered a human who could understand the audio-streamed burst code robots commonly used to converse among themselves when they weren't using packet radio, much less speak it. His accent was horrible. It wasn't a form of communication that human speaking apparatus was very well suited to, but intelligible. "We were dancing and he just stopped," she coded when she'd recovered from her surprise. "His energy levels are okay, but I don't know his diagnostic language well enough to pin down the source of the trouble. I think there must be something wrong in his subprocessor array." Maybe, Corwin mused, speaking normally again. If he thought it at all weird that two robots had been dancing in an otherwise empty stateroom on the VOQ, he gave no sign. "I'm not too familiar with his model, but the old saints always did this kind of thing when their motivator diodes blew. Have you got a Phillips screwdriver?" Better than that, she had a sonic screwdriver. They had Wally's front panel off in seconds. Said Corwin. Peering inside with the aid of a spotlight Eve was projecting, like her scan grid, from within her casing. "Well, you've got a lot of corroded leads in here, little fella. That can't be helping." He gingerly moved a couple of circuit boards, leaving them connected by their faded old ribbon cables, and then nodded. "Yep, looks like your central motivator diode has failed, and the backups, well, they look like they were already gone." He turned to Eve. "I don't suppose you've got any spares around?" "No," she replied, looking alarmed. "We have plenty of spare parts for his mechanical systems, but almost no electronics. They didn't weather the scrapyard very well." Corwin sat back on his haunches and rubbed the back of his head thoughtfully. "If we were in my workshop back in New Avalon, I could fix this no problem. I've got a whole box full of stuff that'd work, and all my tools for that matter." Then, remembering something he'd seen on the EVE Mark 35 spec sheet, he turned to Eve with a smile spreading slowly onto his face. "How'd you like to run a little search-and-retrieve mission for me?" he asked. Eve became instantly attentive. "Directive," she said aloud. In the small stateroom set aside for him next to his office up on the admin level, Griffin looked up from the book he was working on at the chime of the intercom panel. "Chief, Stargate Control," said a voice. "Go ahead, Stargate Control," he replied. "Chief, Lieutenant Perkins here. We just had an uncommanded Stargate activation, and that new Stark Industries probe droid came through here like a bat out of hell. Looks like the destination was HQ New Avalon. What's your recommendation?" Griffin raised an eyebrow. I recommend that you don't stand in front of the gate, Lieutenant, he replied. If she went through alone, she'll be back. Roger that, Chief. Stargate Control out. While Eve was gone, Corwin busied himself with a deeper investigation into which systems needed overhauls, which was pretty much all of them, and what parts they had on hand. Wally was in no particular danger from the particular hardware failure that had befallen him, so while he took stock, Corwin made light conversation. Seems like you've really been through the grind, my friend, he observed as he jotted a diagram of Wally's main subprocessor array on a piece of VOQ stationery. How'd you end up here on B6? Wally tilted his head, considering how to reply, and then croaked, "Eva." Corwin smiled. Ah, he said. Cherchez la femme, eh? I don't blame you. She's beautiful. Wally mustered the effort to wiggle slightly, clearly pleased that Corwin thought so. He wasn't completely naive. He knew most humans would simply have been humoring him with a remark like that. But some bit of cybernetic intuition told him that this human was different. This one meant it. He could see. He understood. That knowledge made Wally much more comfortable with the prospect of being in his hands, with the help of Eve's, of course, for the delicate repairs to come. Friday, March 5th, 2410. 8:30 a.m., Avalon Standard Time, Green Sector Diplomatic Quarters. To her considerable surprise, Lutina slept pretty well that night. She woke feeling refreshed and, almost, ready for the day ahead, only to find herself, after a shower and a light breakfast, with an hour or so to kill. Lingering over her morning coffee, she pondered how to go about killing that hour, then smiled as she hit on the perfect thing to finish settling her nerves. With motions made smooth by long practice, she dug her SimSense deck out of her suitcase, unpacked it, set it up on the coffee table, and taped on the trodes. Then, settling back on the sofa, she reached out and thwacked the green button. The fizzing sensation of SimSense transition picked her up from the sofa and dropped her in a small white room with a control panel and an old-fashioned telephone on the wall. There was a thin, hawk-nosed man in a white coverall and cap standing by the panel, making some notes on a clipboard. He looked up as she arrived and smiled broadly. "Ah, guten Tag, Captain," he said with a marked German accent. "What can I get for you today?" Years before, when she'd set out to learn what she needed to know in order to earn a Starship Master's Certificate, Corwin had taken Utina into a sensory simulation for the first time in order to illustrate a point. The simulation had been at the launch of Apollo 11, the first expedition by Earthmen to their planet's only moon, 30 years before first contact. Over the years since then, she'd made something of a hobby of collecting simulations of early space flights, and by 2408 she'd amassed a sizable number, enough that keeping track of them was starting to become a pain. Corwin had solved that problem by developing an expert shell program to help her manage them and presenting it to her on her birthday that year. He'd based that program's persona on Günther Wendt, the leader of NASA's launch pad crew back in the 1960s, the character version of whom was a fixture in many of the sims. Günther the program wasn't a true AI, but he was a pretty sophisticated interactive shell, and Utina had become inordinately fond of him. Now she smiled and said, "Good morning, Günther. Let's have, Apollo 8 today. I don't have time to do a landing." Günther nodded and made a couple of notes on his clipboard. "Excellent. I assume you'll be playing the role of Frank Borman, yeah? A marked improvement, if you don't mind my saying so. And that's no reflection on Frank. Let me just get it set up for you. Shall I leave Lovell and Anders or Scrubs him?" 9:30 a.m. The Garden. By 9:30, the guests were beginning to arrive. The ones arriving this early would have a fairly long wait. The ceremony wasn't scheduled to begin until 11:30, but there were a lot of people to get seated, and those who could had been specifically asked to stagger their arrivals in order to make the process go a little more smoothly. In the meantime, there were tables of appetizing snacks laid out in the meadow, and cheerful uniformed ushers to direct people to their seats. Since the wedding was being conducted on an Asgardian basis, the seating arrangements deviated slightly from the standard sort of breakdown. Utina had no living blood relatives, and she was the adopted daughter of the groom's father, so instead of the usual family of the groom, family of the bride arrangement, Corwin's maternal relations and people who had known him before he met Utina were being placed on his side, while his paternal relations and Utina's proliferation of friends and colleagues gravitated toward the other. The two of them had practically no friends not in common anyway, so the whole thing had been at once simple to arrange and complicated to balance. The real difficulty, of course, was that there were so many of them. The lives of the two principals in today's little drama had intersected a tremendous number of others, and almost all of those whose lives they had touched were invited, from the core diplomatic and operational staff of Babylon 6 to members of no fewer than 4 space navies, independent operators, private citizens, university professors, duelists and Jedi knights, divinities and demons. And most of those who were invited were making the scene. Dressed in formal wear or uniform, armor or ornate native garb, they numbered in their hundreds, and they were still arriving. Fortunately, the ushers, who were actually members of the Einherjar, the immortal army of Valhalla, permitted to visit Midgard this day thanks to a special dispensation from the Allfather, were well-drilled and on the ball, and as the place filled up, there seemed to be no difficulties. Duelists arriving from Sephiro? Here. Corwin's childhood playmates from Asgard, Tomodachi, and New Avalon? There. Friends Utina had made in the course of her adventures with the International Police Space Force? So. Everyone had a place, and no one seemed to mind who they ended up near. With so long to go before the ceremony, most people mentally marked the location of their seats and then repaired to the snack area to mingle and chat, giving the whole thing something of the air of a reception at the wrong end of the day. Standing next to Corwin's Aunt Beldandy, the master organizer of all this, Lieutenant David Corwin took note of it and asked, "Isn't it more customary to feed people after the ceremony?" Bell smiled. "Oh, we will, certainly. That's what that building over there is for. This is just to make sure no one falls over during the ceremony. Besides, if some of the guests are angling for hors d'oeuvres, it makes it easier for the boys to herd the rest into the right seating areas." Bruce, observing the ebb and flow of the meadow's increasing human tide, had to admit she had a point. "Well, things seem to be going smoothly so far," Bell said. "I must be off. I have an important part still to play." Chad Collier stood at the corner of the snack table, eyeing the assorted Asgardian fare and pondering how best to sneak another bacon-wrapped scallop onto his plate. He'd sent Spark out to take some candid shots of the reception guests, while Janice and X staked out a path to their seats in case there was a rush when the gong sounded, or however it was they'd be notified it was time to sit down. Engrossed in logistics as he was, he didn't notice the approach of another guest until the other man spoke. "Chad Collier?" "One and the same," Chad said, turning to greet the newcomer. At first, Chad took him for some associate of Sumire Kanzaki's. Middle-aged, gray ponytail, mandarin collar on an expensive suit. The other man wouldn't have been out of place at any pitch meeting at the studio, sitting in the corner and asking hard questions about budgets and completion bonds. The left-handed handshake he offered Chad was unusual, though, as was the plain, unadorned metal cap that terminated the man's right arm. "I thought so," the other man said. "There aren't too many Kilrathi cult filmmakers out there these days." Chad returned the handshake and smiled. "Yeah, well, raised on Alderaan, human parents, what's a boy to do?" he replied with a self-deprecating shrug. The other man smiled a bit sardonically. "Affront to everything your species stands for, what?" he said dryly. "I guess a lot of native Kilrathi would think that," Chad replied. "I try not to hang out in those circles." The other man's smile broadened into a smirk. "I bet they just hate this, then," he said. And before Chad's eyes, he changed, growing taller, broader, heavily furred and scarred, still missing that hand. That paw, Chad corrected himself before realizing just who, precisely, he was looking at. The enormous white and black Imperial Kilrathi with the ice-blue eyes looked down on him, expressionless, silent. "You," Chad managed, every hair on the back of his neck standing erect. "Me indeed," Sivar replied. "We have much to speak of, Chad." "I don't know," Janice said, toying with her margarita a short distance away. "Everything's a little pear-shaped, I guess, and there's been a lot going on." X nodded. "Nothing wrong with that, Red," he replied. "None of us exactly have a nice, placid, suburban life to fall back on, you know." "Better than anyone," she said with a wan smile. I don't know if I'd have it. She cut her sentence short as a low rumble echoed through their end of the garden. X's head snapped up. Chad, he said. How do you... No time, X said. Come on. They got up and made their way back over to the buffet table as decorously as possible, Mitra and Riddick in tow. About 30 feet away, they both saw it. Chad, fangs bared and hackles raised, facing off with an older man in a dark business suit. X motioned Janice to stop. You know that guy? X said quietly. Janice shook her head. Never seen him before in my life, she replied. X remained still, expression wary, body tensed. If Geek starts some shit here, he replied, you gonna cover me? Janice nodded. Good enough, X said. Beyond that, we're gonna wait right here. Chad struggled to contain his emotions. You're responsible for all this, he said. All the years people have figured I'm some kind of fucking wild animal, some sort of goddamn religious fanatic. All the shit I went through proving to Karen's parents that I wasn't going to snap and sacrifice their daughter to you. Your fault. I have nothing to discuss with you, Sivar War God. I would that we would speak with sheathed claws in the manner of the civilized, Sivar replied, unruffled. The civilized, Chad replied derisively. Like your priestesses? Like those Kilrathi who go forth to rape and murder in your name? I am still not speaking to them, Sivar replied. And I am still speaking to you, my son. Chad froze, recalling a years ago adventure with Raoul Duke and Ezri Tegan on a long-lost ringworld. You son of a bitch! Where have you been? I have turned my back upon those who call me their god, Sivar replied. The ringing finality in his voice made some part of Chad's hindbrain flinch. I do not expect to be received with reverence by those who have rejected me. And yet, among their numbers, I find my true children. We've had this discussion, Chad said coldly. I'm not convinced. Where the hell have you been all this time since Tatooine? Have your comrades in the International Police not moved against those who call themselves my archpriests? Sivar asked. Have you and your sworn brother Xander Cage not spoken valiantly in the defense of Shan Bastila against those who would have seen her expelled from the Jedi Order? Have you not lifted your own claws against the tyranny and fanaticism of the Covenant upon the Great Ring? Have I not been with you, Chad Collier? Have you not acted to stem the tide of darkness that threatens your friends, your family, your entire galaxy? Have I not looked upon your works and found them worthy of honor? There is a lot of roaring going on over there, Janice observed calmly. Her hand was beginning to ache from its grip on her barista. Indeed, 343 Guilty Spark replied. The little protocol drone had completed his photographic tasks for the time being and come back to find his master in... Well, certainly it was trouble, just not any sort of trouble Spark would have recognized as such. I didn't know Master Chad spoke Imperial Kilrathi, Spark added. His fluency is impressive. X's eyebrows shot up his shaved head. He doesn't. Chad still stood frozen. You were a voice in my head, he said softly. A drug trip. Duke whacked me up on mescaline, and my brain dreamed you up to scare the shit out of me. Sivar shrugged. And yet I remember our conversation, such as it was, he replied. I remain convinced that I spoke the truth, as I speak the truth now. I have not been with the Kilrathi, whose creation I oversaw, whose hearts are now closed to me, for many years. With very few exceptions. You've been the fanged sword hanging over my head every time I met a Kilrathi who wasn't Brit or the Bastard Sons, Chad said. The model of Kilrathi warriorship, the epitome of everything I never want to be. Mighty Sivar. I hated myself every time I bought into a piece of that, and now I'm not sure what to think. I am still Sivar War God, the white Kilrathi replied. That you may have no doubt. But if I am somewhat less than you expected, you are more than I could have imagined. The powers of darkness have come to strike at the heart of your adopted kin, and you have set them back, time and again. Your loyalty, your love, although you do not speak of it easily, is the true way I had intended for my people." Chad looked down to the floor, suddenly overcome. "Thank you, sir," he finally managed. "I know your heart, Chad Collier, as do others among my company," Sivar said. "We are a warrior race, a band of hunters, a people set apart. And I will have my final hunt, my revenge against those who have defiled my worship and dragged our people into a dark age. I will yet see them cast low, but you must promise me something." "If I can do it, I will," Chad said. "Avert your course from mine until I have conquered my prey," Sivar said, gripping Chad's shoulder tightly. "Avert your eyes from my hunt until its final moments. Upon that day you will behold my wrath, and the punishment given to heretics, and I would subject my children to neither." Chad nodded numbly, almost unable to comprehend the words. "I will," he said haltingly. I'll stay away. I don't know where you're going, but I'll stay away." Sivar nodded. "That is all I may ask until my hunt is concluded. Shall we attend to other matters?" With that, the Kilrathi war god assumed his Norse aspect once more, plucked a single scallop from the platter, and placed it on Chad's plate with a smile before moving off to another part of the garden.